Before we begin this episode, I would like to remind you that starting in June and every month after that, True Crime Fan Club Prime will premiere on Patreon. For just $10 a month, you can hear cases that I wouldn't normally cover on the main show. TCFC Prime is driven by what patrons want to hear. I will be covering the case of James Byrd Jr. for the first episode. If you're interested in hearing more content, head to patreon.com/TCFCpod.
Explicit content is found in this episode. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. When you think of mass murder, you often associate the act with school shootings, workers going postal, or domestic acts of terrorism. What you don't often think about is family. The deadliest case of familial mass murder in the United States took place in the last place anyone would think of, in a sleepy hamlet in Arkansas. From the outside, he looked to be the perfect father. But the secrets revealed following the aftermath of this heinous crime shocked the state and the nation. Okay, on to the show. On December 22, 1987, Margaret Neely, who taught at the Dover School District in Arkansas, received a Christmas card from one of her favorite students, Loretta Sims. Loretta had addressed the card to "the best teacher I've ever had." Neely, who taught Loretta Spanish for 4 years, recalled her as the perfect student. Loretta, an honor senior, even taught a Spanish class each morning at the elementary school. This fond memory Neely recounted of her student would also be the last time that she ever saw her. Loretta was the fourth of seven children of Ronald Gene Simmons Sr. and Rebecca Becky Simmons. Her older siblings were Ronald Gene Simmons Jr., William Simmons II, and Sheila Simmons McNulty. The younger siblings were Eddie, Mary Ann, and Rebecca. Ronald Gene Simmons Sr. was born July 15, 1940, in Chicago, Illinois, to Loretta and William Simmons. On January 31, 1943, William Simmons died of a stroke, but within a year, Loretta Simmons had remarried to another William, William D. Griffin. Griffin was a civil engineer for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. In 1946, Griffin was transferred to Arkansas, which would be the first of many moves across central Arkansas over the next decade. The family landed in the town of Hector in the Ozark foothills in Pope County. Ronald loved the outdoors. When the family transferred 80 miles or 129 kilometers away to the city of Little Rock, he did not like it and started throwing tantrums. He was already fighting with his siblings, and the move made matters worse. His parents enrolled him in a Catholic school in Little Rock for troubled boys, but he was returned home within a month. He was then enrolled in the Morris Academy in Searcy, Arkansas for the 1955-56 term. But on September 15, 1957, at the age of 17, Simmons dropped out of high school and joined the United States Navy. He was first stationed at Bremerton Naval Base in Washington, where he met his future wife, Rebecca Becky Olibari. Becky volunteered for the USO and met Simmons at an event. Becky had grown up as one of several children on a cattle ranch in Walsenburg, Colorado. She left the cattle ranch and moved to Southern California. She had at least three sisters, Edith Nesby, Viola O'Shield, and Matilda Guillory. Edith and Matilda lived in Colorado, while Viola lived in Alabama. She was quite close to Viola. Becky had two brothers, Abe and Manuel Ulibarri, both of Colorado. Her mother May and stepfather Andy Novak lived in a ranch in Briggsdale, Colorado. Becky and Simmons married in Raton, New Mexico in 1960. Abe Ulibarri was the best man and thought Simmons was a good guy, especially since he was in the military. In 1963, Simmons's six-year enlistment with the Navy was up. He joined the U.S. Air Force about 2 years later. Many records state he had a 22-year military career, but with this break in service, it was more of a 20-year military career. Between his Naval and Air Force careers, Simmons attempted to enter the world of banking, but lasted less than 6 months before he realized it was not the world for him. Simmons served in Vietnam for 2 years. He was awarded the Bronze Star, the Republic of Vietnam Cross, and the Air Force Ribbon for excellent marksmanship. Simmons worked for the Office of Special Investigations, or the OSI, in the Air Force, and was with the OSI in Vietnam. He enjoyed the secrecy of the OSI. His Bronze Star was awarded for exhibiting coolness under pressure during the 1968 Tet Offensive, although the OSI were not under direct attack. After serving in Vietnam, Simmons was stationed in Italy. Then he was sent back home. Once stateside, he was sent to San Francisco, where the hippies of the Haight-Ashbury scene thoroughly disgusted him. Simmons excelled in administrative work and was a born paper pusher. In 1973, Simmons was sent to England, where his relationship with Becky entered a new stage. He started to physically and emotionally abuse her. He was a ravenous reader and read whatever he could get his hands on. He loved to espouse his knowledge to everyone and belittle Becky for her accent and country girl upbringing. Simmons always ran his household as if he were still on base. He controlled everything, particularly the finances. He did all the grocery shopping, and Becky even had to ask him for stamps. He controlled the mail and read everything that was sent to their address, regardless of who it was sent to. He also dictated outgoing mail, so Becky and the kids had to sneak any private mail out of the house. There was never a phone in the Simmons household. This was a luxury and would have given too much freedom to Becky and the children. In 1976, the family was moved again, this time to Cloudcroft, New Mexico, when Simmons was reassigned to the Space and Missile Systems Organization. They remained in Cloudcroft after his retirement in 1979, living in a house they couldn't afford. When their daughter, Rebecca Lynn, was born, there were complications, and Becky's daughter urged her not to have any more children. Jean was furious, seeing this as a threat to his own virility. Becky pleaded with him, explaining that she might die if she were to bear more children, so Simmons reluctantly allowed her to have a tubal ligation. In reality, Simmons already had someone in mind to replace Becky as the object of his love and desire, and she was close at hand. Simmons had always loved his oldest daughter, Sheila, more than his other children and more than Becky. He never tried to conceal the fact that she was his favorite, always giving her the best presents at Christmas and calling her his little princess. During the summer of 1980, Jean took a road trip to California with Sheila as his sole companion. It was during this trip that Simmons committed his first unforgivable act as a father. He raped his 16-year-old daughter for the first time. Sheila, shy anyway, withdrew further, ashamed and helpless and with nowhere to turn. Within several months, she realized she was going to have a baby, something she tried to hide from everyone, including herself. It soon became obvious to everyone, however, that she was pregnant. On the night of Sheila's prom, on what should have been an ecstatic occasion, Simmons told Becky and their two oldest sons, Gene Jr. and Billy, that Sheila was going to have his child. Gene's reaction was one of joy, but understandably, Becky and the kids were shocked. The only thing putting a damper on Simmons' joy was the fact that he could be arrested, so he ordered them to all be quiet. Gene Jr., however, a protective big brother, told a social worker. An investigation was launched, and social services filed a request to remove Sheila, Loretta, and Marianne from the home. Before this could happen, the Simmons were on their way to Arkansas. Simmons had always dreamed of returning to Hector, his idyllic childhood home. When he made it back to Arkansas with most of his family in tow, he rented a home in the small town of Ward in Lonoke County. Ward is about 25 miles north of Little Rock. In the early 1980s, it was mostly rural, although it has recently seen a great deal of growth due to the nearby Little Rock Air Force Base. For many years after this horrific crime, people would drive by the rental home in Ward and whisper, "That's where Ronald Jean Simmons used to live." Simmons' iron rule continued in Arkansas. The family was not even allowed to answer the door when he was not at home. Simmons went to work at the Veterans Administration Medical Center in Little Rock, which meant the family was completely isolated while he was at work. Simmons was having serious financial problems, still owing a great deal on the mortgaged property in New Mexico and trying to support his family at home. The youngest of these now was Sylvia Gale, his daughter/granddaughter with Sheila. Simmons continued to rape Sheila once they moved to Arkansas. In late 1983, Sheila was pregnant again. Even though Simmons was strongly opposed to abortion, he reasoned it out and decided that allowing Sheila to have an abortion was the best option. He and Sheila went to Dermot, Arkansas, so she could have the procedure done in secret. Sheila began attending business school in Little Rock, where she met another student, Dennis McNulty. They liked each other and began dating in secret. Soon, she trusted Dennis enough to tell him about her home life and who the real father of Sylvia was. Simmons continued looking for a home in Hector, even making trips there trying to find property to buy. After searching for a while with no luck, he finally found a place outside of Dover, Arkansas, which was 12 miles away from Hector. While Simmons was working on finding a home in Arkansas, Steve K. Sanders, the district attorney of Alamogordo, New Mexico, filed an indictment against Simmons for incest. Sheila spoke to Sanders about the charges and begged him to drop them. She admitted they'd had sex, but she said this was her fault. Sanders refused to drop the charges and prepared an arrest warrant for Simmons. However, when they finally had an arrest warrant in hand, they discovered Simmons had fled the state, so the indictment and the warrant were dropped. The new home in Dover was on 13 acres. Simmons' new castle was actually two mobile homes pieced together. There was no indoor plumbing, so they had to use an outhouse. Soon after moving the family to Dover, Simmons named their home Mockingbird Hill. Their driveway was named Little Princess Lane in honor of Sheila. Eventually, Sheila announced to Simmons that she was in love with Dennis McNulty and that she was going to marry him. In September 1984, Sheila married Dennis and the newlyweds moved to his hometown of Camden, Arkansas, home of the Arkansas Law Enforcement Training Academy. Simmons did not take this news well, telling her he would see her in hell. Jean Jr. was still in New Mexico, where he had married Wilma, and the couple had a daughter, Barbara Jean. The pair had met while he was a food service worker at Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico. Billy was married to Renata and lived in her hometown of Fortis, Arkansas. With his family shrinking, Simmons tried to turn his attention to Loretta as a replacement for Sheila. But Loretta was stronger than Sheila and was able to resist her father better. She was very sarcastic to her father. Because they did not have a phone, Loretta had to write letters to her friends during the summer and then sneak them out of the house during shopping trips. Letters written to her friend, Karen Warnick, show a miserable teenager trapped in a hellhole. They were written in the summer before her senior year. Loretta reported to Karen that she was depressed and missed her friends. She said, quote, "We don't have to go anywhere. I really just need to be with just a friend and try to cheer up. I'd rather be dead than go on like this. My dad hates me, says I'm not good enough, yet he claims I'm conceited. And you can't talk to my mom about anything. She doesn't understand." Karen said that Loretta was isolated because Simmons would not let her drive. And although there was a phone in the house, it was just there, reminding the family that they could not use it because Simmons had all the control and he refused to get it hooked up. Loretta also told Karen that Simmons was a cold person. Her mom was saving money to get a divorce from him. He made Loretta and all the other kids work all the time, carrying rocks and wood from one place to another on the farm. It didn't have any meaning to it. It just kept them busy. Her mom was sweet. She was a nice lady. She was nicer when he wasn't around. She seemed scared when he was home. I met him once. I said something like, "How are you doing?" He just kind of grunted and looked at me. "What are you doing here? You're invading." Another letter from Loretta to Karen said, "When I'm at home, I can't be depressed unless I'm alone because I have to keep everyone else joking and laughing, or they fight like my mom and dad." She told Karen that she had tried to commit suicide by taking some pills. Another friend of Loretta's, Liesl Smith, had a similar opinion of Loretta's father. She said, "He was the keeper in his kingdom. The look he gave you in his house was, 'When are you leaving?' It was creepy." Liesl and many others reported that Loretta and the rest of the family were not allowed to leave the house except to go to school and to run errands for Simmons. The females were not allowed to wear makeup because Simmons did not want them to look good. Liesl said that Becky was always worried about trying to keep the kids quiet and out of Simmons' hair, especially if he was in the house drinking beer and watching television. Loretta was number 3 in her class at Dover High School and had been crowned as Valentine Queen in her junior year. Her grandmother provided the dress for her, as her parents were not involved in it at all. Loretta was not allowed to date, but her mother helped her sneak out of the house for dates. Loretta dated John Pike without Simmons' knowledge. He had never been inside their house, although he had met Becky Simmons and, like everyone else, thought she was a nice lady. Summer Mooney of Dover was considered Loretta's best friend and was allowed to spend the night with Loretta sometimes. Summer said that Simmons stayed to himself in a smelly dark room and drank. Even though Becky was still timid around Simmons, she was becoming bolder behind his back, even calling him fatso. In letters to her sisters, she revealed that she was ready to leave Simmons. Simmons' carefully controlled life was unraveling. He could feel his family slipping away from him. His finances were in shambles, and he was forced to take low-paying jobs that he found demanding. He worked as a clerk at Sinclair Mini Mart and also at Woodline Motor Freight, both in Russellville. At Woodline Motor Freight, his boss was Joyce Butts, a woman which he found particularly emasculating. She reprimanded him once for doing a task incorrectly, which infuriated him. To compensate, Simmons attempted to start a relationship with Kathy Kendrick, a 24-year-old who worked at Woodline Freight. He asked her out, but she said no because she was married. He persisted, bringing her flowers, even sitting on her doorstep sometimes. These actions made Kendrick very uncomfortable. Kendrick finally saw no choice but to report him to Butts, who once again reprimanded Simmons. Simmons quit his job at Woodline. Simmons no longer cared about his personal appearance. He became unshaven, his hair was unkempt, and he was slovenly. Simmons was obsessed with privacy and had the children construct a fence of cinder blocks around the property. The neighbors often saw the children carrying buckets of water from the road up the hill. Recently, he had made the children start digging a second pit for an outhouse, claiming the first one was full. By December 1987, Becky had decided to leave Simmons. Her grown children and sister Vi had convinced her to leave. She had always been afraid to because of finances, but the others made her realize that she would receive some of Simmons' military benefit and child support. She also stood up to him and threatened to turn him into the police. In a letter to her son Billy and his wife Renata, written just before the holidays, Becky says, "I've remembered a lot what you said, Bill. I am a prisoner here and the kids too. I know when I get out, I might need help. Dad has had me like a prisoner, that the freedom might be hard for me to take. Yet I know it would be great, having my children visit me anytime, having a telephone, going shopping if I want, going to church. Every time I think of freedom, I want out as soon as possible." Christmas had always been special for the Simmons family, even for Simmons, who became jollier and easier to be around. For Christmas 1987, Becky and the kids at home were giving themselves the gift of freedom. Becky had been corresponding with Gene Jr. and had plans to leave over the holidays. However, Simmons had also made plans for this Christmas. In October, when he discovered the entire family would be home for the holiday, he began finalizing his plans. On December 18th, Simmons quit his job at the mini-mart. On December 22nd, 1987, Loretta, Eddie, Marianne, and Rebecca Lynn all went to school. As usual, Simmons drove them to the bus stop and watched them get on the bus. After they were on the bus and on their way to school, he continued on to Walmart, where he purchased a .22-caliber revolver to add to his existing gun collection. When he returned home, he plugged in the Christmas lights, picked up a crowbar, and took the loaded revolver down the hall. He entered the room where his son Gene Jr. was sleeping. He hit his son in the head and shoulders with the crowbar, which woke Gene Jr. He jumped up and tried to defend himself, but Simmons shot his son once in the chest and four times in the head and face. Once his son was dead, Simmons strangled his three-year-old granddaughter, Barbara Jean. Simmons shot his wife, Becky, in the head, then waited for his four children to return home from school. Once they returned home from school, he told them he had a special Christmas present for them that he wanted to give each of them separately. He took each of them, starting with Loretta, and strangled them and drowned them in a rain barrel. He then threw their bodies into the pit the children had dug, believing it was a latrine. Becky, Gene Jr., and Barbara Jean joined these family members in this grave, which was 150 feet away from the house. Simmons poured kerosene on their bodies, believing the smell would cover the smell of decomposition, thereby not attracting animals. He covered the bodies with wood, barbed wire, and a piece of tin. Simmons then went into the house to drink and watch TV. On December 24th, Simmons went to Sears to check to see if some presents he had ordered had arrived. He visited a bar and had a beer before returning home to drink more beer and watch more TV. On December 26th, the rest of the family arrived for the festivities. The first ones to arrive were Billy, Renata, and their infant son Billy. Simmons ushered the couple into the dining room, where they were shot, and then strangled his grandson. Next to arrive was his long-abused daughter Sheila and her husband Dennis, along with Sylvia and their infant son Michael. Sheila was shot in the dining room, whereas Dennis was shot coming in the door. It's speculated that he heard the shot and was running into the house to check on his family. Sylvia witnessed her parents' murder and attempted to run and hide in a bedroom, but Simmons found her and strangled her. He also strangled Sylvia's baby brother. All of the adults, except Sheila, were laid out in the living room floor, covered with coats. Sheila was covered with her mother's best tablecloth. On December 28th, Simmons drove into Russellville and drove to the office of Peel & Eddy Law Firm. Kathy Kendrick, Simmons's former object of desire, was working as a receptionist at the law firm. According to Brenda Jones, who was sitting in the waiting room, said Kendrick approached Simmons and asked, "Can I help you?" Without a word, Simmons shot Kendrick four times in the head, turned and looked at Jones, then left. Simmons' next stop was a Taylor Oil Company. Simmons found Rusty Taylor, his boss from the mini-mart, and shot him. He turned as J.D. Chaffin walked up and reflexively shot Chaffin. J.D. was an employee of Taylor Oil who was also an off-duty Russellville firefighter. J.D. died instantly. Workers from the oil company called the police, but Simmons was already on his way to his next destination, the Sinclair mini-mart. When he reached the mini-mart, Simmons shot at David Sawyer but missed. Roberta Woolery, the cashier, reached for the phone to call the police, but Simmons turned and shot her in the face and shoulder. Sawyer threw a chain at Simmons, but Simmons managed to get a shot off, which hit Sawyer in the head. After Simmons left, Woolery was able to call the police, even though she was gravely injured. She identified Simmons, but had no idea where he might be headed next. Simmons' next stop was Woodline Motor Fright, where he shot his former supervisor, Joyce Butt, in the head and chest. Simmons then told Secretary Vicki Jackson to call the police. He told her, I've come to do what I wanted to do. It's all over now. I've gotten everybody who wanted to hurt me. He asked her why she never came to see him at the mini-mart, and she comforted him by saying that he was never there when she stopped in. Simmons put his weapons on her desk and silently surrendered when police arrived. He first gave an alias, but due to eyewitness accounts, police were soon able to correctly identify Simmons. When Simmons was taken into custody, he refused to speak to the police. However, the police soon became worried about his family. Every time they asked about his family, his lips quivered and his eyes welled up, but he would not say anything. Sheriff James Bolin of Pope County feared the worst and took a deputy to Simmons' property. When Bolin and a deputy arrived at the Simmons home and looked through the windows, they saw blood-spattered walls. Entering the home on the premise that there could be someone alive who needed medical assistance, they entered the home and discovered the bodies of Billy, Renata, Dennis, Sheila, and Sylvia. Finding no one alive, law enforcement obtained a search warrant for the property and returned the next day. Investigators focused their outside search on an area covered with tin and barbed wire, where they discovered the mass grave of the Simmons children and his wife. The bodies of baby Billy and Michael were found in different abandoned cars on the property, inside dark green garbage bags. During the investigation, 20 audio tapes were found in Sheila McNulty's possessions. These had been sent to Sheila from Gene. One of these had a recording of the song, "You Were Always on My Mind" by Willie Nelson, and in the background, Simmons was sobbing. During his trial for murdering Kendrick and Chafin, Simmons requested the death penalty. He received the death penalty for these murders and for the annihilation of his entire family. His statement reads, "I, Ronald Gene Simmons Sr., want it to be known that it is my wish and my desire that absolutely no action by anybody be taken or in any way change this sentence. It is further requested that this sentence be carried out expeditiously. I want no action that will delay, deny, defer, or denounce this very correct and proper death sentence. My attorneys have repeatedly counseled me to appeal. However, that is not what I want. I believe now and always have in the death penalty. I say in my particular case, anything short of death would be cruel and unusual punishment. I am of sound mind and body, and have been seen by psychoanalysts who can verify that I am capable of making a clear and rational decision. I have given clear and careful thought and consideration, so there is nothing that will cause me to change my mind. I only ask for what I deserve. Let the torture and suffering in me end. Please allow me this right to be in peace." Simmons would not speak to reporters, with the exception of KTHV's Ann Jansen, who he thought had a resemblance to Sheila. He wrote to Jansen on October 24, 1988, Sheila's birthday, and she was granted access to interview Simmons several times. She said later that these interviews were difficult because he would refuse to answer certain questions. He did admit that he was remorseful and that he missed his family, but would not comment on why he killed his family. He was paranoid and thought his cell was bugged. Simmons waived his rights to appeal, so no appeals were filed automatically for him, as happens in most states. However, two people filed appeals on his behalf, Reverend Louis Franz and Jonas Whitmore, a fellow death row inmate. They did this not so much to help Simmons, but because they were afraid that his refusal to file appeals would hurt other death row inmates. Their appeals on his behalf were tossed out of court unceremoniously. It was determined that the Reverend had never even met Simmons and that Whitmore did not have a case as Simmons' next friend. Simmons' execution warrant was signed by Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton on May 31, 1990. His execution was set for June 25, 1990. Simmons was the first Arkansas inmate executed by lethal injection on June 25, 1990. His last meal was filet mignon, 2 raw onions, tomato slices, a banana, 6 rolls, and a 7-Up. He took to the grave with him the reasons he annihilated his entire family. None of his remaining family would claim his body, and he is buried in a potter's field at the prison. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. It really does help us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast. You can also find us on Instagram, TCFC_podcast. And of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. If you have an episode request, send us an email, TCFCpod@gmail.com. Audio engineering and custom music for the show was provided by Nico at WeTalkOfDreams.com. Follow him on Twitter at WeTalkOfDreams. This episode was researched and written by Suzanne St. John.